Standing on the State House steps, Governor Phil Scott this afternoon made Vermont political history by signing several gun control bills into law. We begin with VPR's Bob Kinzel, followed by a report from VPR's John Dillon.
Thank you very much.
This was the scene that greeted Governor Scott as he made his way to a podium in front of the State House. Opponents yelled and heckled Scott throughout his 20-minute speech, often calling him, quote, a traitor and a liar, while supporters chanted, thank you, thank you. At the beginning of the legislative session, it was unthinkable that lawmakers would pass these bills and that Scott would sign them into law. But the mass shooting of students in Parkland, Florida, followed a day later by the discovery of an alleged shooting plot by a former student at Fairhaven Union High School, totally changed Vermont's political landscape on this issue. Scott told the crowd that the Fairhaven case had a profound impact on him.
I believed, since we are such a small, tight-knit state, that we were different and somehow insulated from the violence the rest of the world is seeing. But I was wrong. And that's not always easy to admit.
Governor Scott's call for compromise and civility in public debate was met by many people too angry to hear it. The boos and shouts of traitor competed with the calls of thank you, Phil. But before the signing ceremony, the scene was a little quieter.
My name is Jennifer Tedesco. I'm from Woodbury, Vermont, and I don't think what our governor is doing today is just.
Tedesco is 17 and carried a sign that read, "Not my governor." She teaches hunter safety and calls the bill that raises the legal age to own a weapon to 21 unnecessary.
It was always 21 for handguns. They didn't need to move it for rifles.
Carol Macy drove down from Lunenburg. Macy said he supported Scott in the past, but the governor betrayed his vote.
It's going to hurt him in the end. Because he's going to lose all these guys in this orange out here. He's lost their vote.
Macy argues much of the new legislation is unenforceable, such as the requirement for universal background checks and the ban on high-capacity magazines. He says the bills don't make Vermont more safe. But Ann Herz of Woodstock feels the opposite. She lost her son to gun violence in 1991 and says it took political courage for Scott to support the bills.
I'm so relieved that these laws are being enacted and signed today. I think it's been a long time in the coming, so I'm feeling really happy about it.
Connie Baxter from Dummerston was also there to witness the bill signing and was disappointed in the reaction. She says she was held up at gunpoint years ago, but the Sandy Hook shooting 5 years ago really got her involved in the issue. Baxter wanted opponents to listen to what Scott was saying.
I thought it was very disrespectful, and I was glad that he didn't let it deter him from saying what he needed to say so eloquently. And I'm happy today, in spite of the catcalling and the name-calling and the booing.
Opponents promised to make the governor pay in November, but supporters of the bills say they will be equally active during the upcoming.
I'm Nina Keck. I'm a reporter with VPR, and I cover the part of Vermont where this story began.
And I'm Liam Elder Connors. I cover criminal justice for VPR. For this five-part podcast, we've used Jack's own words, police evidence, court records, and conducted dozens of interviews. This is a story about a young man who had plans to shoot up his former high school.
He told detectives that he had been reading books on the Columbine shooting.
Plans that were foiled by a teenager.
I know I need to tell someone, like, immediately.
As our country grapples with school shootings and how to stop them, this is a story about a school shooting that didn't happen and how it caused a Republican governor in a rural state to change his mind about gun laws.
In the aftermath of Florida, this situation in Fairhaven has jolted me.
It's a story about the decisions people had to make.
So is it your position that no crime was committed here at all?
And about how sometimes when something happens close to home,
I had to do some reflecting, some soul searching myself.
Things change.
Sign those bills! Sign those bills!
It's late morning on Tuesday, February 13th in Rutland, Vermont. An 18-year-old named Jack Sawyer walks into Dick's Sporting Goods and heads to the back corner of the store. On the wall, more than 150 guns are lined up parade style between displays of kids' hockey skates and plastic deer decoys. Jack hands over his Vermont driver's license, fills out a 4473 firearms transaction form, and just after 11 that morning, walks out with a pump-action Maverick 88 shotgun and four boxes of ammunition. The next day is Valentine's Day, and 1,500 miles away in a town called Parkland, Florida, a 19-year-old former student shoots and kills 17 of his classmates and teachers. You probably remember.
Now to a developing story that we're tracking in
firing. Those who could ran, hiding in classrooms,
Florida,
even closets.
This took place in Parkland, Florida, at Douglas High School.
Meanwhile, here in Vermont, Jack Sawyer target shoots with the shotgun he bought the day before. Now he can cross the gun off the shopping list he keeps in a college-ruled spiral-bound notebook. On the cover of that notebook, Jack has taped a title, The Journal of an Active Shooter.
It's Friday, February 16th, 3 days after Jack Sawyer bought that shotgun at Dick's and 2 days after Parkland. I'm in a conference room across from the governor's office waiting for a briefing from state officials.
Good afternoon, everyone. Tom Anderson, I'm Commissioner of Public Safety. This has been a very sad, disturbing, and tragic week for the United States and Vermont.
That morning, I'd gotten a press release saying police had arrested an 18-year-old for threatening, quote, to cause mass casualties at a high school in Fairhaven, Vermont. It's the first time I hear about Jack Sawyer. Honestly, I figured he'd made a bad joke about shooting up a high school. Police are probably dotting their I's and crossing their T's because Parkland is so fresh on everyone's mind.
In Florida, 17 families have been forever changed, a school has been forever changed, and a community has been forever changed.
Some TV stations are taking the press conference live. A handful of state officials are just a few feet in front of me. I hope I'm not blocking the cameras.
In Vermont, the Fairhaven Police and the Vermont State Police yesterday arrested an 18-year-old who was aiming to cause the same type of horror and mayhem in Fairhaven.
Then a major with the Vermont State Police takes the podium.
Good afternoon. Glenn Hall, I'm the major of the Criminal Division.
Slowly, methodically, the major lays out what Jack Sawyer told police.
He told detectives that he was planning from a couple of years ago to shoot up Fairhaven High School. He told detectives he did buy a shotgun the previous day.
Jack told detectives he'd come back to Vermont to carry out the shooting, although Jack said he hadn't thought about the plan for at least a week.
He detailed specific plans as to how he was going to carry out the shooting. He said he would have carried out the shooting, but wasn't sure when.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Representative Kaya Morris, a Democrat from Bennington, announced in a Facebook post last Friday that she is withdrawing her candidacy and will not be seeking re-election. She's served in the State House for the last 4 years. In the post, Morris says that in the last 2 years, quote, political discourse and in particular within the sphere of social media has been divisive, inflammatory, and at times even dangerous, end quote. She also pointed to some of the accomplishments she was most proud of over her time in office. This week, Vermont's Attorney General's office said they're investigating online threats that have been made against Representative Morris, who is one of the few people of color in the legislature. Today, Representative Morris joins us to talk about why she made the decision not to seek re-election. Can you tell us the nature of them? What specifically can you say?
I don't know that you need to hear the minutiae of it at this point, and especially since there is an ongoing investigation on it and they're doing forensics to try and determine the source of the threat and the breadth of this entire case. But it's been so pervasive in our life that I can at least tell you my son saw one of the threats, and he's 7 years old and was fully aware and understanding of what it said and what it meant and had questions about it. And this is it's something that's unacceptable to have happen for anyone, let alone someone who chooses to step up and serve. It's not acceptable for any Vermonter, any individual to endure that and to have to wrestle with that and accept that as a normity within all of the the scope of everything that we're trying to do and live as individuals beyond our public roles.
If you got a traffic ticket recently, you're not alone. Drivers in Vermont paid a combined $4 million in traffic penalties last year. After receiving a well-informed tip, VPR started looking into which Vermont towns write the most traffic tickets and why. Today, VPR's Emily Corwin takes us to Windsor County.
Erica Bazawi is at traffic court, writing a check for $100, her traffic fine.
Did I just make it out?
Bazawi giggles about getting caught speeding twice in the same week by the same deputy.
I feel like he's the only Windsor County sheriff that I see.
Really?
I do.
Good news, he cut her a deal. Bazawi lives in Plymouth, home to Vermont's most aggressive speed enforcement. Last year in Plymouth, sheriff's deputies issued over $415,000 in traffic fines. That's substantially higher than the vast majority of towns.
I think everybody has gotten pulled over there.
I got to the Windsor County Courthouse after sorting a spreadsheet and finding Plymouth at the top for most revenue from traffic fines. With so much money at stake, I have to ask, is somebody profiting from all these tickets?
I don't get one penny of that revenue.
First to Sheriff Michael Chamberlain.
It's not like the state sends me a check.
It's true. The state does not send Michael Chamberlain a check. However, some of that revenue does make its way to his bank account. See, each year, a couple thousand motorists pay fines after getting stopped in Plymouth. The state keeps a hefty cut and sends the rest to the town. Last year, that was roughly $220,000. $220,000 is almost exactly how much the town spends on its contract with the sheriff's department. And the sheriff himself gets to take home 5% of all of his contracts. That's according to law. Last year, Sheriff Michael Chamberlain took home roughly $10,000 for his contract in Plymouth. This is not illegal, and Chamberlain may not have bad intentions. It's the towns, after all, that choose how much law enforcement they want. Plymouth hires a lot. 12 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Sorry about that.
That's all right. I'm Emily. You must be Ralph.
Ralph, yeah.
Nice to meet you.
Ralph Michael is chair of the select board in Plymouth. His board decides how much law enforcement the town should hire.
Should I sit right here? How about that?
Yeah, whatever. Sure.
We met at the offices of his engineering company.
They are speed traps to them because they got a ticket. The deputy sheriffs do not hide.
Michael says there's a reason for deputies to issue a lot of tickets here. Speeding on this road, he says, is a particular danger.
If they're going to have bicycles on Route 100, we really need to have the road fixed for bicycle. This place is on Route 100. You can't even stay on the edge of the road with a car.
Michael says some enforcement is good. But he also says the deputies shouldn't spend all their time ticketing motorists.
We have in the past had a lot of break-ins, especially like hunting camps and things like that. Their presence has greatly reduced the amount of break-ins and that. And one of the things I have been mentioning with them is we want you to go.
Vermont dairy farmers are experiencing some of the hardest times in recent memory. The State Agency of Agriculture says 12 farms have gone out of business this year, bringing the number of working dairy farms down to around 750 compared to about 1,100 10 years ago. But across the border in Canada, dairy farms are thriving. The reason is a complex system that regulates the supply of milk and sets the price farmers receive. VPR's John Dillon went to Quebec recently to learn more about the Canadian system of supply management.
It's a short drive from Jacques Rainville's place in Highgate Center to Saint-Armand, Quebec. And along the way, Rainville, whose family came from Quebec, points out yet another farm gone fallow.
Gone. No cows here. I could have named them all down the road here. We got another one on the corner here. Beautiful farm. Nice little family farm. No cows. It's sad to see it happen.
Like his father before him, Rainville farmed for over 30 years. He drives a milk truck for work now, but says he's still a farmer at heart. We're visiting Canada with his cousin, Phil Parent, who has a dairy farm in nearby Enosburg, Vermont. As we approach the border with Quebec, Rainville says he thinks the Canadian system, which balances milk supply with consumer demand through production quotas, offers a valuable lesson for Vermont.
The buyers react to oversupply because they know we have to get rid of it. and it's a downward spiral that's going to go down to who can produce it the cheapest in the world. Okay, we got to get our wallets out.
We stop for a minute at the Canadian border.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
Open the window,
please.
Yeah. Thank
you, sir. Jacques Greenville, Highgate Center here.
And where are you going today?
Oh, we're going to the Kaiser farm.
Just a few miles down the road, Hans Kaiser and his son milk about 95 cows. A tall silo next to the barn bears the farm's name, Hepatica, for one of the first wildflowers of spring.
Got a special visit?
Oh, it's beautiful.
How's it going?
The senior Kaiser is tall. He wears overalls and rubber boots and has an accent that doesn't sound Quebecois. He came here from Switzerland in the 1970s. In the barn's milk room are six people with strong ties to the land. The Kaisers, two other farmers from Quebec, plus Rainville and his cousin. Introductions happen in French and English. The Canadians practically talk over one another as they explain and praise their system of supply management. Here's Hans Kaiser.
I came to Canada in 75. We always had this quota system. I believe we have the best system in the world. I have no doubt about this.
The quotas in Canada can be bought and sold, and they're quite valuable, several million dollars or more for an average farm. The price farmers are paid is also controlled. It's established based on the cost of producing milk on what's deemed to be an economically efficient farm. The system is not financed by the government, although it has led to higher retail prices for milk than in the U.S. And even though the quotas are expensive, banks lend money to buy them. Quebec farmer Gerard Vemelin says, why wouldn't they lend?
They know you're going to have that revenue. Well, they're going to get paid.
The farmers do a rough calculation to compare the price the Canadians receive compared to their Vermont counterparts. It turns out the Quebec farmers are getting the equivalent of $24 for 100 pounds of milk, while a few miles over the border, Vermonter Phil Parent is paid about $14 a hundredweight. The comparison is sobering for Parent. He says the Agrimark co-op told him recently that milk prices were headed down in 2018. Included in the letter were numbers for a suicide hotline.
So how do you feel when you see that? I was a little taken back by that. I know they meant well, but there were four farmers in New York that killed themselves. They fell dead, no recourse. And something's wrong with this industry. Very wrong.
For Jacques Rainville, the crisis also hits close to home. His son took over the farm several years ago when prices were high. He borrowed to buy a herd but couldn't cover his debts when the price plummeted. So he sold his cows to a startup dairy in Canada.
And I'm the one end up buying his herd.
Philippe Swenin is 39 and says supply management in Quebec allowed him to get a start in farming.
We started from nothing. I didn't have nothing. You can ask anybody in here. And today, I bought two more farms, and I'm up to 47 cow, and I'm going to be up to 60 cow in the probably next 6 months.
Dairy farming is a business that demands attention at least 12 hours a day, 365 days a year. But these four Quebec farmers say they can balance their work so they get at least one day off a week, plus vacation. Gerard Vemerlin says there's something else he notices about farms in Quebec.
This is not nice what I'm going to say, but I think you people need to hear it. Go in Quebec. Drive around in the countryside. Look at the farms. The tin is painted. The tractors are put away. There are nice farms in the States. I'm not saying they're all run down. But there's a lot more farms that are run down in the States than in Canada.
Vermont's midsummer primary took historic national significance on Tuesday, with former utility executive Christine Hallquist winning her race in the Democratic primary for governor. In doing so, she's become the first openly transgender candidate in U.S. history to win a major party gubernatorial nomination. VPR's Peter Hirschfeld has more.
It was shortly before 10 o'clock Tuesday night when the Associated Press called the race for Christine Hallquist. When it did, the dozens of supporters who turned out for her election night party could barely contain themselves. On Tuesday, democracy looked like this. a transgender woman standing on a stage in a bar in downtown Burlington, Vermont, accepting her party's gubernatorial nomination.
I must say I'm incredibly honored to have all your support and all the things that I heard were said. You know, tonight we made history.
That reference to, quote, history would be Hallquist's only nod to her gender identity. While Hallquist has embraced her role as a trailblazer for the LGBTQ community, she says she prefers to wage her campaign in the policy arena. And as she heads into a general election race against incumbent Republican Governor Phil Scott, the policy contrasts are stark.
And we want to get the message out to Vermonters that Phil Scott is not doing us any favors in these areas that we all support.
Hallquist supports the $15 minimum wage and paid family leave bills that Scott vetoed earlier this year. She supports a ban on the sale of so-called assault weapons. She wants to create a legal retail market for cannabis in Vermont and use the revenue to pay for clean water initiatives. And perhaps most notably, she's vowed to deliver fiber optic cable and high-speed internet to every home and business in Vermont.
No matter how small our communities are in the state, we got to take care of them. And that includes keeping their schools and keeping their downtowns.
Hallquist easily won her four-way race against Brenda Siegel, James Ellers, and 14-year-old Ethan Sonneborn, with all but.
This is the VPR, Vermont PBS Governor's Debate on Vermont Edition. With us today are the two major party candidates for the position, the incumbent, Republican Governor Phil Scott, and Democratic challenger Christine Hallquist. And now we're going to have some time for questions from Vermonters. I want to thank everyone who submitted questions in advance of the debate. Candidates, please limit your answers to 60 seconds.
First question comes from Ellen.
Lead that North American solution.
Our second question comes from John in Bennington, who says, how may property and school taxes be reduced for Vermont residents? How will you help? Christine Hallquist?
Well, I got to tell you, first of all, this idea that, you know, we're going to have less and less and less and less students is I totally challenge that. Because, again, where we've connected fiber, every home and business with fiber, we've changed that. In fact, on NPR last week, you heard about a Kentucky community that was a coal community that connected every home and business with fiber and changed their demographics. We studied this. We looked what's happened in the 30s. In the 1930s, we saw aging demographics, flights to the city, increasing rates of poverty. It's when the cities had electricity and rural America did not. We will connect every home and business with fiber, rebuild those downtowns. We will grow those communities. We're going to grow rural Vermont. We're going to add students to the school. So that's a key part of it. And also, I will tell you, we need to also restructure the way we pay. If you look at the property tax system itself, it's a flawed model. Moving to an income-based model, you know, one of the things that breaks my heart is to see elderly people that have to leave their home because they're on fixed incomes. So we'll look at that model as well.
Phil Scott?
Well, you can rearrange the deck chairs on the Titanic here, but that doesn't change the outcome. So you can go to an income tax-based model, change the formula, but if you're not going to address the spending, you're going to have the same result. It's coming out of a different pocket. So I fail to see how that's going to work. In terms of broadband, great idea. We need to do this more in the state. But I think you'd be shocked to learn that some of the top 13 communities throughout Vermont that have the highest capacity broadband, fastest broadband in Vermont right now. Burlington is one, no surprise, but Brattleboro, Springfield, Newport, Bennington, not exactly thriving economic centers right now. So they're working on that. They already had that. But we have to look at this. We have 30,000 fewer kids than we did 20 years ago. We're still losing kids every single day.
Today we continue our series They Are Us, stories from inside Vermont's mental health care system. It's produced by Erica Heilman. In today's story, you'll hear from two parents about what it's like day to day to care for an adult child living with schizophrenia.
When he went to the hospital the first time and was having the evaluation, the medical evaluation, I was hoping it was a brain tumor. That would kill him, but please don't let it be schizophrenia. Don't let it be that.
That's Connie Stabler. Her son was diagnosed with schizophrenia when he was 19, just as he was becoming independent. He didn't believe there was anything wrong with him. He did not want to seek treatment. And since he was legally an adult, His parents stood by and watched his life fall apart.
That's when he told me, and I remember we were out on the porch and he was pacing back and forth and saying, you know, I'm on a mission from God, and I don't know what it is yet, Mom, but it will be revealed to me. I've received this gift, and there's nothing wrong with me. I've just received this gift.
You look at Facebook to try to get hints of what is happening. And we found posts saying, you know, that he was living out of his car. He was sleeping in the Walmart parking lot. So one day I got up very early in the morning, 4 o'clock, and I just traveled over the Walmart parking lot. And there was the car. And the car looked trashed. I didn't confront him at the time. I went back home. Boy, and it's like, what is going on?
It was in the spring. I was at work and he called me and he said, Mom, I'm trying to get to the Howard Center and I'm lost. He had been taken there once by his dad. So I told him now to get there. And he told me that he had almost hurt his girlfriend. And that's what made him so afraid and made him know that he needed help, that he had seen something, a monster coming out of her face, and he started to lunge at her, but hadn't hurt her. But the fact that he saw that and he almost hurt someone was what precipitated him wanting to get help.
Well, after we had episodes and run-in with the police over, you know, him destroying property. You know, as parents, we said, this isn't like our son. So we're thinking, okay, this is something that we have to get our hands around and it'll pass. So going to NAMI, there's such a steep learning curve for dealing with something like this.
NAMI is the National Alliance on Mental Illness. I heard about the support group and I went to that and I cried there for the first year or two. But what happens sometimes when you first go to a support group, you hear everybody else's stories and that they've been dealing with it for 30 years. And you just feel like, oh my God, it's going to take my rest of my life.
So
is gonna
there's,
be like-
there's this grieving because you're... You're thinking about, you know, all the dreams and aspirations that you had for your loved one. Marriage, them getting a career, and you see that is drifting away. It's a whole new expectation level that you have to get used to. And it comes to life just meeting someone in the store. And asking, you know, how's your son doing? You know, we happen to be friends with my son. And you hear, oh, he graduated college. Oh, he has a degree. And here, and, you know, how can you not reflect on where your son is?
Over the last 20 years, the state of Vermont has authorized more than $10 million in payments to Keurig Green Mountain. The company, known for its K-Cup pods, is just one of many businesses that have used state incentive programs aimed at creating jobs. But as VPR's Henry Epp reports, how much money Keurig received and what they did with it, that's shrouded in secrecy.
You know Keurig machines. Maybe there's one in your kitchen or at your work. You pop in one of those little plastic cups into the holder on top, close the lid, hit a button, and in a few seconds, you've got a warm cup of coffee or tea. This company started out as a small coffee roaster in Vermont. But about 10 years ago, its products got really popular. And that meant big profits and major growth. So how did that happen? A lot of factors, including money from the state of Vermont designed to create jobs. Most of it came from a program called Veggie, and I'm not talking about carrots and broccoli. Veggie stands for Vermont Employment Growth Incentive. Here's how Veggie is supposed to work. The state promises to pay back a company like Keurig after it can prove that it created jobs or made investments. Keurig has been approved for the most money of all companies that have become eligible for the payments. But exactly how much they received and what they did with it, I wanted to find out. So I called Casey Mock.
Hi, this is Casey.
This was in March of this year. At the time, Mock was the head of the Vermont Economic Progress Council, the board that calls the shots, read, decides who gets the money for the veggie program.
To have that information and by connection the jobs associated with that information publicly available would present a problem.
Mock quickly told me that there's a state law that prevents him from telling me how much money the state gave to Keurig or what they did with it. The reason, he says, to protect a company's proprietary information, like a prospective contract or product. Mock's advice for finding out how many taxpayer dollars the state paid Keurig, ask Keurig.
And of course, like, whatever Keurig tells you that they're happy to disclose, you know, it's not like we're going to stop that.
Sure.
Either.
Sure.
So I reached out to Keurig. I asked them for documentation of the actual payments they received from the state and of the number and types of jobs created with that money. No immediate response. And then in April, nearly 3 weeks later, Casey Mock, with the state, calls to tell me the company will be in touch.
You will be hearing from them, and they'll be sending you a statement.
The statement the company sent over claimed the program made it possible for Keurig to, quote, maintain a strong physical presence in Vermont and create over 2,000 jobs and spend over $450 million. What the statement does not say is whether or not those jobs would have been created without the incentives. It also does not say anything about exactly how much money the company has received from the state. A Keurig spokesperson would not provide me with an interview or a tour of their headquarters in Waterbury. Businesses are used to keeping their information private, but taxpayer dollars are usually subject to public scrutiny. This lack of transparency bothers State Auditor Doug Hoffer. Hoffer thinks at least the number of jobs created by these awards should be public.
I think the people of the state have a right to know. I don't think employment data would compromise the integrity of the firm.
Even though it's not out in the open, there is a cost-benefit analysis built into the veggie program. When a company comes to the state with a proposal, and before the state gives out a veggie award, they run that proposal through a model to figure out how much the state would benefit. Casey Mock showed me a redacted version of this system.
All right, so I brought a copy of what we'll discuss for you.
Okay. The model weighs things like how much new employees will spend on lunch.
As well as, you know, wear and tear on the roads, that kind of stuff.
Still, we can't see how all this played out for Keurig. As far as the actual payments from the state to Keurig, the Commerce Department considers those to be tax returns, so they too are confidential. Meeting minutes from the board that oversees Veggie are public. During one meeting in 2007, the company, which was known as Green Mountain Coffee Roasters at the time, told the board it might expand outside Vermont, and it called public funds critical to staying here. I'd hoped the meeting minutes would reveal how much money was spent and on what. But every time the board actually discussed whether to approve Keurig for a veggie award, that appears to have happened in executive session, meaning there's no public notes of what was said. The next question is, what has the state gotten for all of this? It's supposed to create jobs and therefore money for the state. But while Keurig clearly grew in Vermont, not all those jobs stuck around.
Waterbury-based Keurig Green Mountain says it will cut approximately 200 jobs in Vermont.
President Trump's policy of zero tolerance on border enforcement has led to thousands of families being separated while trying to enter the country. But removing parents from their children is not just happening at the southern border. In Vermont, a young man from Kenya will be deported this weekend, and he does not know when or if he will see his American wife and children again. VPR's John Dillon has this story.
5-year-old Rahima Ranga opens her music box in the living room of her Randolph Center home. The young girl is hanging out with her father, Carl, a stay-at-home dad who's been her primary caregiver. It's a fleeting moment for them to share. Carl Ranga is scheduled to be deported on Sunday on a one-way flight back to Nairobi. Ranga says he knows his situation is not as dire as that faced by families at the U.S.-Mexico border, but it's tough on his family, especially Rahima and his two other children from an earlier relationship.
I'm not saying going back to Kenya is horrible. I was going back to South America, some other countries, you know, so, but it's the pain of the children, the trauma. It's very hard, like, to tell my 5-year-old what's going on. It's very hard for my 13-year-old to comprehend.
Ranga has been in the U.S. for 17 years. He came here to attend the University of Massachusetts. His trouble with immigration authorities began after he overstayed his student visa and later filled out a government form for a temporary job in Vermont at IBM. He says he checked the box on the form indicating he was a U.S. national. He says the form was confusing and that he made a simple mistake.
There was a first box which you check, U.S. citizen slash national. The other one I think was green card holder, and I think the other one was like alien number if you had one. So I figured out national was the best choice because I came in legally, but, you know, I'm somewhere in between. You know, I'm not an alien, I'm not a green card holder, but I'm definitely not a U.S. citizen, but it was either or.
Way on those hillsides over there. That's how far their sound carries. They don't call if it's raining or if it's too cloudy or if it's too windy. And they also, they're really linked to the phases of the moon. So during the waxing moon, the full moon, and the waning moon is when they call the most. So they'll reliably call at dawn and dusk. But then if you want to catch them throughout the rest of the night, like on a full moon, they'll call all night. But during the other phases of the moon, it's just like after the moon is up and creating enough light for them to come out and feed.
You can see why they come out now, though. I keep looking in the edge of the forest here. There's lots of moths.
Oh, yeah. I think... Oh, is he started up again? We're so close to him that we can hear his clucking.
Yeah, did you hear that? It sounds like the clucking sounds like a chipmunk.
Yeah. And if you can only hear it if you're really close to him. Three whippoorwills that we can hear right now. There are two that are right in front of us and then one really far away on the hillside.
It'd be great if they could use their big mouths and come out here and take some of these mosquitoes away, though. I'm trying to imagine in my mind's eye what it looks like. So he would be parallel with a branch, singing, I guess. Because they're not perching birds, so they have to sit parallel to it.
And they don't call when they're flying. So when you hear, when they stop singing... And then they start up again. Oftentimes it's because they've moved.
Oh, the one behind us is coming closer. Sorry.
Yeah, that's okay.
It's like stereo sound now.
It's great,
isn't it?
On each
side of us.
I think we got four whips, actually.
Really?
So I think we've got two over here and then two back up here.
Is that a record?
No. Oh. It isn't, but it's a lot. This has definitely earned its name as a whippoorwill hotspot of Vermont.
So now to keep this as whippoorwill habitat, it's still light enough that I can look out in this field and I can see that there's... well-spaced shrubs.
Mm-hmm.
We've got beautiful woods behind us where they're singing from.
But it's also got an open understory. The woods behind us has an open understory.
They'd have to mow this once in a while, right?
Absolutely.
He's really close.
He's right on top of us. Like, I almost think if we walked back in there, we could find him.
Well, I think maybe we should head back to the truck and before I lose most of the blood to mosquito. Feeling like
I am from Westmore, Vermont, which is the town next door.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm. Could I just ask you to say exactly what your question is? Like, I'm wondering about X.
Yeah. My question is, just how culturally different is the Northeast Kingdom from the rest of the state? Can it be quantified in any way, or is it largely legend?
People who live in the kingdom know what they are.
A little bit, I wouldn't say dumb, but, you know... A little not sharp.
The Northeast Kingdom's got the reputation of maybe people being a little rednecky.
You're considered a redneck because it's just a small town and...
Redneck, you know, there's like less education here.
It's kind of the bastard stepchild of Vermont in their eyes, not ours.
The worst employment rate.
Yeah, I mean, people do. They think we have nothing here. You know, we're backwoods. You know, they're like, oh, you have internet access? I'm like, yeah, we have really nice high-speed internet access in town.
Good morning. I'm Mitch Wertlieb, and this is VPR News. National attention has been focused on high-profile recounts in Florida in recent weeks, but the Sunshine State is not the only place looking back at vote totals from this month's midterm elections. Three local races in Vermont will be recounted in the coming week, as VPR's Henry Epp reports.
County clerks are preparing to run votes through tabulators again in the race for state's attorney in Addison County, the state rep race in the Grand Isle-Chittenden district, and the race for probate judge in Franklin County. That's where Democrat Robert Farrar asked for a recount after finishing just 256 votes behind Republican Vaughn Como. James Pelkey is Franklin County clerk.
I sort of anticipated this race would be close. I wasn't sure how close, but I anticipated it would be close. And then it was.
The recount begins in Franklin County on Thursday. Pelkey expects the count to finish within a day. For VPR News, I'm Henry Epp.
This year, the town of Randolph lost its entire police department due to a series of resignations and retirements. Select board member Larry Satkowicz says the town is now gathering data and figuring out whether Randolph really needs a full-time police department.
We're just kind of taking it all in to come up with a picture of what is going on and then trying to figure out what is the appropriate level of policing that we really need here in Randolph.
Satkowicz says the public is split on whether the town should invest a significant amount of money to have its own department. VPR's Howard Weiss-Tisman will have more on the story coming up later today during All Things Considered. More than 10,000 people visited Smuggler's Notch over the past hiking season. The Green Mountain Club says the number of people who checked in with volunteers at the Barnes Camp Visitor Center in Stowe more than doubled compared to last year. The Moyle County Planning Commission Principal Planner Seth Jensen says some new sections of the long trail, including a wheelchair and stroller-accessible boardwalk, were a big draw.
Last year, with the boardwalk opening, this spring, the long trail relocation was complete, which pulled the long trail trailhead parking from sort of up the mountain a bit down to Barnes Camp. We've seen a really substantial increase.
The visitor center is now closed for the winter, as is Route 108 through Smuggler's Notch. And there are winter weather advisories and winter storm warnings in effect for central and northern areas outside the Champlain and St. Lawrence Valleys tonight right through tomorrow night, according to the Eye on the Sky forecast, and a wind advisory for the southern mountains late this afternoon and tonight. Forecast for today, cloudy, areas of dense fog this morning, rain, mountain snow develops through New York into southwestern Vermont and the Berkshires late this morning, spreading northeast by afternoon, highs in the mid-30s to low 40s.